So this morning's big idea, this morning's big thought, where we're going to be taking a look at a very awesome passage of Scripture. You can turn there if you'd like to now. It's going to be Acts chapter 19, verses 21 through 41. It is 20 verses describing a riot, a literal, out-of-control mob, and how the first century church, specifically the Apostle Paul, dealt with this very, very challenging situation, which could be succinctly defined as, what do Christians do when confronted with overwhelming odds? When things are just not in your favor, what is or what are the tools available to people of faith when dealing with, you're on God's mission, God's calling, God's purposes in your life, you're on track, but you're confronted with overwhelming odds. Now, overwhelming odds can be kind of fun, and I think there are a number of different areas and times in our lives where we are faced with overwhelming odds, and we kind of enjoy it. For instance, when you and your spouse were first starting out and you started to have a family, there's a very important conversation that happens between child number two and child number three. And everyone has had this conversation who has started having children, and the question is, man-to-man or zone defense? That's a very critical question to ask when you've had two children and you're thinking about having a third. Are we going to stick to man-to-man, or are we willing to go to overwhelming odds and start playing a zone defense? You better have that conversation before the third child comes around, because there are some critical changes that need to happen in your parenting skills and abilities between man-to-man defense and zone when you're raising a family. So this conversation happens, but it's kind of a fun conversation. God is bringing new life into your family. You know that's going to have challenges financially. You know that's going to have challenges on your time. You know that the dynamic in your house is going to have to change course to the corresponding number of little ones that are coming in. How much do the little ones help with the other little ones? Do you bring in family members to help with the little ones when you're faced with these overwhelming odds? And it's not a depressing conversation. It's a fun conversation. And overwhelming odds when it comes to how many children you're going to have is kind of fun. Teachers deal with overwhelming odds all the time. And if you think they don't, go and try and teach for a day. It's you against 20 kids, or at least of varying ages. I don't care what age you choose, it's overwhelming. Do you go with the cute and cuddlies who can't tie their shoes? Do you go with the students who can tie their shoes, but now they can run their mouth a little bit more? Do you go with the middle schoolers who they're just crazy, you don't know what's gonna happen, or go with the high schoolers who just walk in and hate your guts just because you have to be in school and there you are? Whatever class you're trying to teach, it's you against them, and it's overwhelming odds. And those who are professional educators, they kind of like it because it is a challenge, but they're able to have classroom discipline and order. They make connections and relationships with the students. They're able to present the material, and they see lives change. And so for many people, the thought of standing in front of 20 young people for 6 to 8 hours a day and responsible for their education, that's overwhelming odds. But for many, many people, it's really kind of fun. Yes, it has its moments and it's challenging, but you're a part of changing lives. So overwhelming odds aren't always terrible. They aren't always depressing situations. But there are times when we are faced with overwhelming odds where we need some help, where we need some help processing. Is this a situation that I'm going to stay committed to? Am I going to jump into these overwhelming odds and take on the challenge that comes with whatever the situation is that you're facing? Or do I freak out and run away? Because that's a valid response sometimes too. For years, I kept honeybees. It started accidentally. There was a colony living in a tree in my front yard, and I was mowing one day, and they had swarmed and were clustered on a smaller tree, and it caught my attention. It looked like a living football. It was a little honeybee swarm on this cedar tree. And so I did what normal people do. I did a quick internet search and decided that I was going to become a beekeeper, and I cut the thing down and hived them and called them my own. And so hence I started beekeeping, and it grew from there. I captured a few more swarms, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I actually bought a few real hives, and I put them together. And I ended up with 4 colonies of honeybees living on our property. A normal colony consists of about 50,000 women with stingers in their rear ends. And that's a normal, so I had, you know, almost a quarter million of these creatures living in a space between these two stands right here in four different hives that I would go out and maintain and manage and tend. Overwhelming odds. Now, for some of us, that sounds like, wow, I would love to work with a beekeeper and figure out what it makes to make a bee colony healthy and go out there with the smoker and take the top off of that thing and inspect the bees and work with them and have them flying all over the place. And others, you're like, run away. Like, there's something wrong with you. Why would you do something like that? And again, partly out of ignorance, but partly because when confronted with these sorts of overwhelming odds, I was so fascinated by the bees and their how they behaved and made honey and all that stuff. I learned that when I wore protective gear, it would make me sweat, it would make me hot, it would make me uncomfortable. The gloves were cumbersome, and I couldn't be as delicate when handling the frames and inspecting the colonies, and so it was my regular practice to go out in shorts and a t-shirt and flip-flops. That's how I maintained those four hives, shorts and a t-shirt and flip-flops. I was cooler, I was actually calmer, and I was much more aware of what was happening because it was just my bare hands. And you bring out the smoker, and it was so fun dealing with these overwhelming odds. I learned something, though, in the process of beekeeping. I'm incredibly allergic to bee stings. I swell up. It's incredibly painful for me to be stung, and I swell up like it's nobody's business. And wherever I got stung, usually it was on the hands or the arms. My wrist would disappear. My fingers would turn into sausages. And basically, from my elbow to the end of my fingers, it was all one size. And it was just very, very painful. And I was still flying for Delta at that time, so I couldn't take anything that would make me sleepy. And so on occasion, I would be flying a regional jet with this paw that I had been stung once. And I just went, bloop. And so, you know, I did some more research, and I learned that, you know, the more you get stung, the better your chances are of developing tolerance to the stings. And your reaction would go down, and your body chemistry changes. It's a lie from the devil. I mean, I averaged anywhere from 6 to 12 stings a year, which wasn't bad considering I was outnumbered 250,000 to 1, and I was out there with shorts and a t-shirt and no protective equipment whatsoever, but they were very painful 6 to 12 times a year. And I needed some perspective. I needed some help. It was fun, it was engaging, and it was overwhelming, but there came a time where I kind of needed to change my ways a little bit. And it was because my sons were now interested in working the hives with me. And it hurt so bad for me to be stung. And I turned into such a swollen creature of disgusting proportions that it was no way to look at my children, oh no, it's okay, it's okay. No, don't worry about the bees flying around, it's really okay. When you look like something out of a horror movie and you're like, ow, 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 and you're trying not to throw things around. And so I needed an intervention. I needed an intervention. I needed someone else's perspective, and then I did start donning the gear, and my sons were more comfortable working the hives with me. Overwhelming odds can be fun. In fact, there are times we find great enjoyment when in the face of overwhelming odds. It could be the fact that you have more than two children. It could be the fact that you have twins, or that you're hearing that you're going to have twins. Those could be your overwhelming odds. It could be a situation at work. Whatever it is you do probably strikes other people as overwhelming. And of course, we talked about professional educators. Or it could be a hobby or an interest or something of yours that, you know, is something that you really enjoy, but to other people it's overwhelming, and they would never choose to be challenged in that way. So the question is, do we jump in or do we freak out when it comes to matters of faith? When is it time to just dig deep in faith, and when is it time to turn around and just let a situation happen and just disengage? So let's see if we can get some guidance this morning from the biblical text as we see the Apostle Paul confronted with overwhelming odds in Acts chapter 19, beginning in verse 21. Most of the verses that I'll be referring to this morning will be on the screen, but of course, it's always easiest probably if you follow along in your own Bible. So beginning Acts chapter 19, beginning in verse 21, let's take a look at the context here. Now, Paul is traveling around, and now after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. Verse 22, and having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. So right now, Paul is in extreme western Turkey, not far from the Aegean Sea at all, in a city called Ephesus. And his intent is to spin around a little bit in Asia Minor, go down to Jerusalem. He has an offering, actually, that he needs to deliver to the saints in Jerusalem. And then it's his desire to then travel to Rome, strengthen the Christians who are there in Rome. And then we know from other passages that Paul has written in other books of the New Testament that he wanted to go to Spain. He wanted to go on a missions trip. And so he was going to bring an offering down to Jerusalem. He was then going to travel to Rome, where he's hoping to raise some money himself, basically, and solidify the work of the church in Rome, and then move on to Spain on his own little missions trip. So this is Paul's resolution that he prayed about, and I kind of titled these two verses God's Purpose. This was God's purpose for Paul. This was Paul's plan. This is how he was going to serve the Lord. It's not a bad plan, and he actually ended up performing most of it. Verse 23, about that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way, which is what Christianity was known as. It was called the way. Verse 24, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands, idols, are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. Enters this strong personality, this guy named Demetrius. He's a silversmith, and he presents a problem. And what's interesting is that from his perspective, it was a real problem. Christianity was beginning to, the way was beginning to make a difference in people's lives. And people were realizing that, hey, this thing that I bought at the market that was crafted out of a precious metal, to call it a god and to worship it and to make sacrifices and to offerings to it, it's silly. Because I've experienced a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And the power of the Holy Spirit is in my life. And there's nothing about worshiping this statue that I can set on a shelf or knock on the floor that has anything to do with a life of faith. And so his trade was beginning to be impacted by Christianity. Christianity was beginning to make a change in Western Turkey. And so this is an important point in the text, and I'm not going to dwell long on it, but I also don't want to skip entirely over it, because it is important that our faith begins to make a difference in the culture, and sometimes the overwhelming odds that we face are in the workplace, where our lifestyle and the decisions that we're making, and possibly even the business that we're involved in, it feels a little overwhelming. It feels like we're in an environment of overwhelming odds. And so Demetrius was making this case, saying, hey, we're going to stop making as many little silver statues if people stop worshiping little silver statues. Interestingly also, and I could talk a lot about this, but I just want to take a moment or two to try and get a sense for the overwhelming odds that they were facing. This Temple of Artemis is also known as the Temple of Diana. You have to remember that the Greek gods and the Roman gods kind of mirrored each other a little bit, and they cross-pollinated a little bit. So you might be more familiar with the name Diana, but it was essentially Artemis. It's the same entity that was being worshipped. This temple was considered, or is considered, the eighth wonder of the world. It was ginormous. It was about six stories tall, with about 150 colonnades all around the outside. It was about 150 feet wide by 300 feet long. It was about 60-some-odd thousand square feet. It was big by today's standards. And it was, each column was a gift of a regional king. And it was lavishly decorated. It was beautifully colored. And to say that it was popular is an understatement. People literally came from all over the world to worship this false god at this temple. So much revenue was brought into this temple by political entities and those wishing to bear gifts and rich people that it was one of the largest financial institutions in the ancient world. It was a bank. People could go there and borrow money and business loans and do financial transactions because so much wealth was collected. Demetrius is not overstating the reality of the trade and the popularity and the cultural dominance of the Temple of Diana. You know, I was trying to think of different ways that I could bridge the gap between the first century and how this temple dominated Western Turkey or the city of Ephesus. And really, you know, the only thing I could think of would be something like if one of the tribal elders came to us at River Church and said, "You guys are a problem," because the message of the gospel is going out so powerfully. People are taking ever-increasing percentages of their income that they would dedicate towards gaming, and now they're giving it to the work of the ministry. It's actually beginning to threaten and change our take at one of the two casinos in the area. That sounds ridiculous to us, that a church would have that much of a regional impact with compared to a multi-million, if not multi-billion dollar industry. The first and the third largest casino in the world, if I understand it correctly, at least it was a few years ago. It might be the first and second largest casino now, I'm not sure. But that's the kind of thing that was happening here. Overwhelming odds. Overwhelming odds. The entire economy of Ephesus, if not Western Turkey, was beginning to be impacted by the fact that people were making decisions of faith. There is no reason for us to buy silver idols anymore. And so they stopped buying them in droves. And it was a problem. And so Demetrius chose to take matters into his own hands. And he presented an economic crisis, but he also presented it as one of faith as well. And the only thing I can kind of liken it to would be that kind of a casino influence in our area. If people were actually getting mad at local churches because local people were losing their jobs because the revenue at the casinos was diving off as people took more and more of their money and put it towards the kingdom of God. That's what was happening here in the first century church. It was a big deal. Overwhelming odds. So let's continue in the text and see where this riot goes. Picking up in verse 28. When they heard this, the local people, they were enraged and were crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." So the city was filled with the confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. So it gets very personal here for Paul. This amphitheater holds about 25,000 people. So about 25,000 people gathered. They begin chanting. They begin rioting. The text goes on to say that they do it for hours, and some of Paul's friends have now been dragged into the middle of this situation. You're the Apostle Paul, overwhelming odds. What do you do? We know, we're familiar with the Apostle Paul. Jesus saved him, and he's been serving faithfully for years now. There's a part of the Apostle Paul that wants to go out to that beehive with no protective gear whatsoever. Let's just preach the gospel. 25,000 people. With one sermon, I can preach the gospel to 25,000 people who are as far from God as they could possibly be. You can kind of see the Apostle Paul saying, let's do this. Overwhelming odds. I serve a big God. What's the worst that can happen to me? They're going to beat me with sticks. They're going to kill me. I really don't care that much because 25,000 people. We can preach to 25,000 people. Or do you run away? Do you say, this is not my situation. This is not my riot. It's not that he was afraid of anything, but maybe this was not for him. This is the situation that is presented to Paul. And now it's getting personal. He's got friends that are in that arena. He's got friends that are in there, traveling companions. Picking it up in verse 30. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing and some cried another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. We're yelling in the auditorium, yay! I hear there's donuts. Why not? Right? Let's go yell and scream in the arena. There's like 24,000 of our friends. Perfect. I've got nothing else going on. They had no idea why they were there. It was just a party. and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd, but when they recognized that he was a Jew for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." So there is an attempt at order. The Jews put forward a fellow Jew, and the bottom line is that the Jews were trying to separate themselves from Paul. If he was able to make a defense, he was probably going to say something along the lines of, please understand that Judaism is different from Christianity, and so if you guys want to yell and scream and shout because Paul is Jewish, that's fine, but please understand that he has nothing to do with being a Jew, that you're yelling and screaming and shouting about the fact that he believes in Jesus the Christ. So more than likely than not, he wasn't there to defend Paul. He was there to distance himself and fellow Jews from Paul so that when the punishment began, the Jews and the local synagogues would not be part of the casualties. And so there is a resulting riot, and there were some personal consequences for Paul. And now we are faced with a point of decision. And we see from the text that there were two voices that were speaking into Paul's life. One were his disciples and his companions, and the scripture says that the disciples would not let him. They were restraining him in some way from rushing into this situation. And then the scripture in verse 31 mentions that even some of the Asiarchs, who were some of his friends, sent to him, said, This is not your battle. This is not your opportunity to preach the gospel with the effectiveness that you think you might be able to. What's interesting about this is we get it that the disciples would say, Paul, this is a death wish. You know, let this riot subside of its own accord. This is not your battle, not today. Who are the Asiarchs? The Asiarchs were families of means, wealthy families, who had moved into Ephesus, and their role was very clear. Their job was to support the cultic worship of the Roman emperor. Their job was to, in the midst of all of this excitement and worship of Artemis, their job was to remind the people that they also owed their respect and worship of the current Roman emperor. And so they were loyalists to the Roman Empire. And they were a family of means, and they used their influence to kind of just remind everybody, that's right, go ahead, party with Diana, party with Artemis, that's cool, but remember that it's Roman freedom, Pax Romana, that makes this possible for you. They weren't Christians, but they were friends of Paul. He had made some friends outside of people of faith, and they too were concerned for him and were speaking to him. And so what's the resolution? I don't have these verses on the screen, but let's find out what does God do in this situation. What's fascinating is as you read Luke's account, not only of this particular episode, but also of Acts in general, and then if you think of the Bible in general, you start to think of different things. You start to think of Moses parting the Red Sea to deliver the nation of Israel from a very bad situation. You begin to think of how God would send hornets and hailstones to fight for the nation of Israel when they were faced with overwhelming odds. You begin to think of Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego and how God protected them from the fiery furnace. You think of Daniel in the lion's den and how God closed the mouths of the lions whose job it was to kill them. You think of Noah and the ark faced with the destruction of the world and how God did something miraculous to protect him. And so we're all ready. We're ready. We are ready to see. They thought the reason they built this temple here, if you go on to read the text, is because a meteor fell from the sky. In the world of history, only the biblical text gives us an understanding of why they built this eighth wonder of the world where they did. And if you keep reading further down, you see why. A rock fell from the sky. And so they declared that this rock was holy, and obviously that this was Artemis reaching out to them and relating to them. And so let's commemorize this amazing event by building a temple here. A rock fell from the sky. And so we're waiting to see, like, maybe God will cause a volcano to erupt. You like holy rocks? Well, let me give you some holy rocks. And, you know, we're waiting to see meteors come from the sky. We've seen this happen so many times in the biblical text. What resolves this riot? Picking up in verse 35. And when, here's a superhero, the town clerk had quieted the crowd. What? Town clerk. John the Baptist was like cool because he had like, you know, camel skin on and, you know, he ate bugs and, you know, we our common depictions of Moses are big flowing beards. Town clerk, whose idea of a hero is a town clerk? Town clerk quieted the crowd. He said, men of Ephesus, who is there that does not know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? And he goes on to remind them that these guys weren't trying to do anything except preach about Jesus. And so he says one thing. Here's the great resolve. Here's the miraculous provision. Take them to court. The courts are open. Demetrius, boys, you got a problem with Paul? Take him to court. The courts are open. Because if you don't knock off this nonsense, and I mean knock it off right now, the Roman government, the Pax Romana, is going to get a little less than peaceful all up in here. So you're rioting for no reason. If you have a problem about a business matter, go take it to court. And so the miraculous provision, due process of law. Yes! What? Due process of law? That's what delivered Paul. Due process of law. That's terrible. That's like the last thing we want to be delivered by, due process of law. We want to see like mosquitoes and volcanoes and meteorites and things parting and things coming together and flames and what? Due process of law? More often than not, in the world of Christian faith, a lot is resolved by Christians being patient and this one critical thing that we're going to talk about and allowing God to use the due processes of law and the way he created this world to resolve the situation. Have you ever found that sometimes we bring more drama to a situation than it's actually there? Does that ever happen to anybody? We love to freak out. Freaking out is fun. It's why we like roller coasters. There's an emotional release that comes to a challenging, potentially overwhelming situation, and sometimes we have the strength and resolve to jump into this overwhelming odds and bring order into the chaos. Other times, it's just really fun to run in and scream, and just lose it, because it's like plausible deniability. Overwhelming odds, what was I supposed to do? And it feels good to kind of just freak out, and we actually create more of a scene or a situation than the one that is actually there. What guided Paul in this scenario? Well, we see it in verses 30 and in verse 30 and 31. When Paul wished to go in amongst the crowd, he wanted to freak out a little bit. He wanted to powerfully preach the gospel and kind of hope that God would either deliver him miraculously or let him die in glory. Perfect. Paul was that kind of a guy. Go hang out with those bees with absolutely no protective gear whatsoever, knowing that you're really, really allergic to them. How does that make your wife feel? And she's not a real big fan of this. And even some of the Asiarchs, they're not Christians. They're just friends in the society, in the culture, in the community, said, Paul, this is not your time. When faced with overwhelming odds, surround yourself with friendly faces. When faced with overwhelming odds, the takeaway from this passage, surround yourself with friendly faces. Why do I think that's an important thing for us to consider this morning? Well, number one, we see that the counsel that Paul received from this group of friendly faces, some of them were Christians, some of them weren't. The one thing they all had in common was they loved Paul. They cared about Paul. Paul had invested himself in their lives, and they had invested themselves in his life. Nobody wanted to see Paul hurt in any way, and everybody wanted to see the gospel move forward. And this was not Paul's battle, because God's purpose was for him to take an offering to Jerusalem and then travel to Rome and try and raise some money to go on a missions trip to Spain. This is the greater context. That was Paul's greater purpose. This was a prayerfully derived at conclusion of what Paul was going to be working towards. And jumping in the middle of this riot was not going to move that godly agenda forward. Paul sensed an opportunity for the gospel, but when he humbled himself and surrounded himself with some friendly faces, that wasn't his day. One of the things that the friendly faces did for the Apostle Paul was they helped transcend a strong, dominant personality, Demetrius. There was a real problem. There was a real situation. Demetrius was not overstating his case. The gospel was powerful, people's lives were changing, and less people were going to be employed in the silversmith trade if the way kept marching forward the way that it was. A very strong, dominant voice, overwhelming. This guy had authority. This guy had power. He had a lot more authority and power. Paul's not the one that's having evangelistic crusades with 25,000 people in the arena, but Demetrius can get 25,000 people together in the arena and keep them there for 2 hours chanting the same thing over and over and over again. He wasn't kidding. He had a lot of influence. But yet the power of a few friendly faces quelled this strong, dominant personality. Sometimes we feel like there's a voice in our life that will just not give us any room to breathe and is actually taking away our ability to serve or worship or live the way we feel that we want to live. It could be a family member. It could be someone in our school. It could be a bully type situation, or it could be someone in the workplace. But there are sometimes loud voices. Who helps us get through these difficult situations? Do you square off or do you back down? That's a tough question. When you are surrounded with overwhelming odds, when faced with overwhelming odds, it might be a dominant personality. Surround yourself with friendly faces. Talk to your people about it. Talk to your people about it, and they will help us process, do we square off or do we back down? It might depend on the situation, because sometimes with loud, dominating voices, they need to be squared off, and sometimes you need to back down and let them blow themselves out. How do we have the wisdom to do that? When faced with overwhelming odds, sometimes a strong personality, we surround ourselves with friendly faces. Quieted the clamor. 25,000 people riding for 2 hours dissipated. They all went home. And what's fascinating about it is the disciples didn't say a word. Not one person of faith said anything. They talked to each other, and I'm sure they prayed about it, but God moved through their silence. There was already enough yelling and shooting, hooting and hollering going on in the arena. God moved through patient, quiet conversation and the prayers of the saints, quieted the clamor, and did it in such a way that no disciple said one word at all. And most importantly, God preserved his purpose in Paul's life, and he also preserved Paul's actual life. That God preserved Paul's got his purpose in Paul's life. This might feed back a little bit. Are you ready for it? Yay, it didn't. We continue to play with speakers around here. Not only did God preserve his purpose in Paul's life, but he also preserved Paul's actual life. The power of a few friendly faces, when confronted with an angry mob of 25,000 people screaming at the top of their lungs for 2 hours, the disciples' response was to surround themselves with a few friendly faces. Quiet prayer and reflection, some encouraging words. God's purpose was preserved. Paul's life was preserved. The riot was subdued, and this dominant personality wasn't an issue anymore. And so I want to encourage us this morning. We have a few opportunities to surround ourselves with a few friendly faces. And of course, we do that on a Sunday morning, and we love to. We love to come here and see people greet us at the door or invite us to have a cup of coffee. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the service, some of them are longtime friends, some of them are new friends, some of them are strangers that you're looking forward to meet. So there's absolutely friendly faces here. But it's hard to kind of communicate on a Sunday morning if there's a riot going on in your life somewhere. It's not always the time on a Sunday morning to get to share with someone that in your life, it feels like you're facing some overwhelming odds. Might be a dominant personality. It might be a decision that you're trying to make with your spouse. It could be a workplace situation or a situation that you're facing in school. And Sunday morning isn't really the time to talk about the riot that's going on. When is the time to talk about that riot? In your small group. That's what it's there for. Yeah, the time to talk about the riot is Tuesday night at the Bradleys. Because absolutely, there's a planned conversation for that evening. But I'm telling you right now, part of the plan is to hear how everybody's doing and to see how we can pray together and counsel each other and to let other people into our lives. Or you might need to go to a small group because you're somebody else's friendly face. Someone in the context of a small group might start talking about something, and you're like that kid in third grade that actually did his homework that day, and you know the answer. You know the answer. You've been down that path before as someone is describing something that God used powerfully in your life. You're like, ooh. You're someone's friendly face that day. That's what happens in a small group. Maybe it'll be Thursday night at the ladies' study that meets at Maria's house. I had to pick up my wife, and only half the women were still there. I'm telling you, what an intimidating thing as a guy. There's like 15 women hanging out in there, doing like girl stuff, getting all close and praying. I didn't want to pick up my wife. I wanted to sit out in the driveway and just honk the horn. But, you know, I can't be that guy, you know. Oh, cool, Pastor Josh. Yeah, that was really classy, you know. I had to go in there. It's intimidating. But they're having a wonderful time of fellowship. Part of the reason is because they were being friendly faces to each other. Some of those friendships have gone back for decades. Some of them are brand new. But there are some friendly faces at that small group, and there's some prayers that are going up by people, for people who know what you're about, and they're connecting. Might be at the Thompsons every other Saturday night. Sure, it's themed around parenting. Absolutely. But you know what's on Kevin and Jen's heart? Being a friendly face. Having an opportunity to talk about what might be a little riot starting up in your life, or maybe you're going to be that friendly face for someone else. Let me tell you about that riot. Let me tell you about how I had that riot too, and then God used this to kind of work through it. And so here's what I would encourage you to do. In fact, let me pray for you as you're going through this transition or this potential little riot in your life. So our job on a Sunday morning is to identify a biblical principle where you can find life and healing and power and truth throughout the week, but you got to go find it during the week. And where you find it is in the context of a small group. Your middle school student might have a riot going on in their life. You know who can talk to them about it with a fresh voice that they haven't already heard? Another leader in this church, or maybe another middle school student or high school student who faced that riot before. And you might have told them the right thing 100 million times. And guess what? You've also told them to do the laundry. You've also told them to get their homework done. You've also told them to put the seat up. And the message of truth that you've put into their lives is just Charlie Brown. Wah, 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 wah. You know who can speak a fresh voice of truth into their life? One of their peer group. Where are they going to meet that person? At a church event, which is part of a youth group, where they find their people. And so the big idea this morning, there's a lot that could be said about this passage, but where we're going to kind of land is when we're surrounded by apparently overwhelming odds or circumstances, it's time to surround ourselves with friendly faces as they help Paul through a challenging, a literal riot in his life. So I'm going to pray for us this morning, and then we're going to have time to give another brief song of praise to the Lord. And I encourage you to think about your week and what time you might have available. And maybe you don't have time for one of these small groups, then call a friend or call myself and we'll get together. Because there's important work of the ministry that takes place when we're able to be a friendly face to each other as we move forward together in faith. So would you join me as I pray?